Well, for our presentation today, we have Reggie Newkirk here with us once again. And you possibly remember he's been here before. And I'll just give you a little background on Reggie. Reggie is well recognized in Saskatchewan for his work to promote culture, diversity, and the protection of human rights. After graduating with a BA in History and Philosophy, Mr. Newkirk worked as Executive Director of the NAPI, the Blackfoot Friendship Association in Pincher Creek, Alberta, and served on the Provincial and National Association of Friendship Centres. Through his volunteer activities and work experience, he promotes a comprehensive vision of culture that includes facilitating positive relations and unity of thought and action. A skilled trainer, facilitator, and big picture thinker, he is also a passionate advocate for culture. He places a special emphasis on young people in the areas of multicultural policy, music, and arts. He has served in numerous capacities in the human rights field with the federal, provincial, and territorial human rights commissions. He currently serves as president of the SAS Cultural Board of Directors, is a former board member for the Regina Jazz Society. He is an associate member of the Multicultural Council of Saskatchewan and the Regina Aboriginal Professionals Association, and a former critical friend of Saskou High School in North Battleford. He currently runs his own consulting company, Parity Consulting, from his home in Lumsden, through which he offers a wide range of training and workshop programs. And today he's going to speak to us on race relations. Reggie, thanks.
Well, good morning, everyone. I can tell this is not a Baptist church, okay? Because we get a little feedback, you know. Hello?
Hello?
Thank you. You didn't say anything. Say something. You didn't move your mouth. Okay. Excuse me. I want to, I don't know if I should dedicate it, but my second sister just passed away. She was in Pennsylvania, and she was a sweetheart. A lot of challenges and that sort of thing and what have you. But as I was raised, when people die, people don't say they go to hell. They say they go home. And I asked my grandmother once, well, what do you mean they go home? Suppose they were a bad person, then home is hell. All right? But because that's the result of your deserts, your behavior kind of thing. He says, but it's not up to us to make that judgment. It's up to the Creator to make that decision. What have you. So on. So I say, wherever she is, I really hope she's happy. Let's put it that way. And she wasn't psychotic, so I don't think she can go to hell and be happy, to tell you the truth. But nevertheless, you never know. Okay, this let me go to my notes. All right. I was given the impression, here is race relations between black, white people in the United States, is Canada doomed to have the same fate? Okay? And what? It's a fan. What are you talking? And I thought about this and thought about this ever since Victor mentioned it to me. And I said, well, to myself, I talk to myself a lot. I don't get any answers, but I do talk to myself. And I just said, well, golly, this is an interesting question, really. And the perspective is somewhat timely. But as I wanted to do, I changed things a little bit. Sorry, Vic. And what I'd like to do is start out by asking you a question, all right? Because the question I'm going to ask you is really the frame to the presentation I want to share with you. Is that clear? Okay, when did women get the right to vote in Canada? 1910, 1916? Hmm? Give me an example. It was. You, yes. That's right. This is the first. You're the first person in any group. The rest of these are turkeys, in any group that actually got that point. But there's others to it too. Okay. When did South Asian, East Indian, Japanese and Chinese women get the right to vote? In Canada. Well, what the heck? Yes, in Canada. I don't know when they got the right to vote in the U.S., even though I was born there, but in Canada. Yeah, what do you think? Yes. Okay, 1946. Okay, and First Nations men and women. 1960, except, and here are exceptions, any First Nations woman who married a non-First Nations man, who, and the man had the right to vote, they would get the right to vote. Okay? My point is this, simply, is that when I went through and looked at different history books and so forth in elementary schools, high schools, they didn't have that. The question was, when did women get the right to vote? And you got the right answer. You said 1919, particularly in 1916 in Winnipeg. I mean, Manitoba, they got. They were probably first off the loop. Why? Because the suffragette movement was more powerful there and really had its origins in Winnipeg than anywhere else in the country, and it spread out from there. Okay, yeah. Because the women were armed. I know. I went to the University of Wyoming and I saw that statue, what have you. So what I'm getting at is this. Part of the challenge in any society is how we frame the nation, our communities. And it's a framing. And to a considerable extent, it's kind of, it reminds me of horses with blinders on. Kind of thing. We say, well, this is the history here, folks, and you got to understand this history and so forth. Women got the right to vote in 1919. That's where it started off in Winnipeg, blah, 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 blah. When in fact, it's like that. Another question. What war, if any, did treaty First Nations people did not participate in? Canadian, that Canada was involved with. Come on, I'm not going to pick on you. You better be right, though. No. Sorry. Well, there was a split in the communities there. Some First Nations did, some got hung and that sort of thing. Others didn't. There was... And that, some of that was, some people didn't want to, Gabriel Dumont was a little bit too material, militaristic for some folks within the community and not and so forth. Yes, sir. Man, that's not in Canada. No, I don't care about them. No, I'm just kidding. But it's a good point, but okay. Yes, ma'am. Oh, you mean the one down there, down east, in the War of 1812? Well, I don't know if you're going to get the Iroquois Mohawk in this or that sort of thing, but they might have. I don't know that, but I'll have to make a note and take a look at that. But really, when the First World War, Second World War, Korean conflict, they were all engaged in those battles from the Canadian point of view. All right? But when I think about it, again, I taught social studies. That wasn't in the book. Okay? And not only that, for the most part, they were fighting in those wars when they weren't enfranchised Canadians. In other words, they didn't have citizenship, by and large. Have you? So here you have non-quote citizens, in quotes, what have you, fighting in wars to protect what? They were there to fight, protect their homeland, not necessarily Canada. Some were. I talked to some veterans and so forth who say, yeah, it was, we were doing it for that. But really, they were fighting for the homeland, what have you. And so when I was thinking about that, and I talked to a couple other classes, and they said, my God, that's amazing. We never heard about that. I said, yeah, that's pretty powerful. I said, now, what were residential schools about? You know, and a lot of those folks who participated in those wars, First Nations in particular, and Métis, I might add, they were, how can I put it? They were proud to participate in those wars. Have you? A lot of them come from a warrior tradition, too. All right. So that's enough of that about history and relationships and so forth. And far as I'm concerned, the biggest and most challenging relationship in the Americas is not based on ethnicity and race. It's gender. It's gender. The biggest challenge still to this day for equal rights, what have you, you can get equal rights legally. But when I go to bars with my friends and hear how they talk about women, it ain't so good. All right? The depiction of women in movies and themes and films and that sort of thing and what have you, plays even, they get to go to occasionally, it's not particularly wholesome. It still remains a big, big challenge because equity and equal rights is more than about being able to vote, get a job, earn a living, and so forth. It implies respect for the dignity of the person. And that area, I feel, that in the Americas, we are still have a long way to go. Let's put it that way. All right. So I got my notes here, and I'm going to go because I hear my wife calling me. She has that effect on me. I said, one of the biggest challenges in terms of our education of ourselves as a society, I'm not talking about the school system right now, is we are challenged to put aside whatever pride or hubris we may have on a particular issue in order to see that issue more clearly, not through the prism or sunglass of pride. Because if I'm proud of myself or my background or whatever, what have you, and I'm thinking about that, I'm not necessarily hearing what's being said. I don't know about y'all, but as I get older, it becomes more difficult to hear and think at the same time. And I think that our educational system is loaded with hubris. They teach virtually nothing about the indigenous peoples of this land. And I'm not talking about the Office of the Treaty Commissioner that has programs and so forth. I'm talking about what happened before the treaties happened. Why did residential schools happen? Why was there such abuse in the residential schools? And not just talking about sexual, there was all kinds of abuses that went on in residential schools and so on. Well, how could that happen? Why did it happen? And it happened because those who were responsible, federal government in particular, their idea was to annihilate indigenous peoples of this land. And until we can accept that, we're living an untruth. Now, I'm not saying that all the teachers were there trying to do that, because we know some that weren't, some did, what have you. But the program of the government in terms of residential schools was to take care of them. Out. There's an expression. See, residential schools didn't start in Canada. They actually started in the United States. And the idea came to Canada from the United States. And I forget the name of the chap that was doing it, but he was in Pennsylvania. He had a connection with the federal government. And they asked him, he was an educator, what can we do to deal with the Indian problem. That was the way they put it back in those days and what have you. And his idea was, he said, what we need to do is to educate the Indian children and to kill the Indian in them. Now, there have been some allegations that certain federal politicians back in the early 1900s made similar statements. They were kill the Indian in the child, what have you. I've not found any verification in my research that is so. But when we look at the impact, that's precisely what was attempted. Look at the impact. Never mind motivation. What was the result of that? And what it's done is that it has had an adverse effect on generations. Generations. Yeah, if the First Nations or whatever, Métis communities are dysfunctional, there is a historical reason for the dysfunctionality. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean I'm responsible or you're responsible for that. People have to take responsibility for themselves and that sort of thing. But, so say, we had a debate in our family. No, well, they should have gone on and gotten their education, blah, 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 and done this and gotten some healing and that sort of thing. I said, well, how do you do that when you don't have a job? Or how do you do that when you have a job that pays, well, minimum wage? How do you get those services and so on? That was before we had a national health care plan in Canada and so on. Now, those are kinds of questions and things that I hear, have you? Comments that I hear. And really, it's coming from where people themselves stand, what their lives are like. Well, if I was, I would do. Well, you're not them, so how can you say that? They ought to do as I would do. That's an expression of lack of compassion. I won't go to empathy, but compassion. So we need to really, as a nation, think differently about these things. Okay. Excuse me. Now I'm going to give you a little test. And I had you in mind, I just want you to know. All right. All right, here's a little test. I'm a fan of history, you might say. And I like modern history, too. But there's a guy named Jack Weatherford. If you write his name down, this guy is an amazing researcher. He's done some excellent, excellent work. And I want to share just a few things from some of his work. He says, he talks about what I call is indigenous people's contribution to civilization. What class did you take where you got that? Anybody here from university? Did you catch that course? I'm not blaming you here, man. Was it available? I don't think so. How about you, ma'am? No? Huh? So, yeah. How many of you got past grade 6 then here? You don't know. Okay. So here's I didn't. In Brooklyn, they didn't do this sort of thing and what have you. But I got to tell you this, Joey. I was having lunch with a buddy of mine. His name is Milton Tatusis. He actually was with the Office of Treaty Commissioner, but now he's not. He's doing other stuff. And I said, Milton, I really feel bad, man. He said, why? I said, you know, when I used to go see those cowboy and Indian movies, you know, I said, you know, we paid 25 cents, so you know how long ago that was, for 6 movies, what have you. And everybody's kids were in the movies because the parents and neighborhood got the kids out for 3-4 hours watching movies. And I said, I couldn't believe it. You know, I said, when I think back on it, you remember when the cavalry was up on the hill and the Indians had the covered wagons and they were shooting arrows and so forth and what have you, and then da-da-da-da-da-da. I said, yeah. I said, I found myself riding down the hill out of my seat, following the cavalry. He looked at me and said, damn, he was sitting on his seat, rising and fighting on behalf of the cavalry too. He said, why? He says, the excitement of the movement. What have you? I said, do you think those guys were doing right by the settlers? He said, that wasn't even an issue. I said, well, that's kind of like me watching Tarzan. How many of you have watched those Tarzan movies, huh? You've never watched a Tarzan movie? culturally depraved people here. Holy mackerel. Well, Tarzan, I'll tell you. I used to go see, I saw everything. Johnny Weissmuller, every Tarzan movie. Okay. I come home one day after about three different feature movies, two Cowboy and Indians and one Tarzan, and I asked my mother. I said, well, it was my grandmother, actually. My mother was working. My grandmother, she had a beauty parlor in the same place where we lived. I said, and I called her mom. I said, Mama, you know the story of Tarzan? She says, yeah. You know, his family were English, and they were flying over to somewhere in Africa, and the plane crashed and so forth. And, you know, I said, yeah. And I said, then he was raised by apes or gorillas. I am not sure which, but she said, yeah. I said, how do you learn how to talk ape? She says, I don't know. I said, how did he deal with puberty? I mean, he was in Apeville, right? And he was raised amongst the apes. Jane came on a lot later. So I said, I know what puberty's like, Mom. I was in the midst of it. I said, I wonder how he managed that. And you know, I've never seen a Tarzan movie that dealt with that issue. I don't blame them, but it's sort of like he was the plane crashed. The parents were killed. A gorilla came along, an ape came along, a mama ape picked them up, took them to Apeville, and raised them. And then next thing we know, he's kind of like looking after Jane kind of thing. I said, isn't there something missing in his education, his story? I mean, what was going on? Okay. Never answered, but it was assumed by audiences and the filmmakers in particular, that you can make that leap from babyhood to teenage and then bring in a human being gal, on the scene and so forth. Think about that. Anyway, I did. I laughed a lot, what have you. So here's some things. We can talk about discoveries that the native or indigenous peoples of the Americas, and I look at it from a broader perspective, made. I won't read this. Oh, yes. How many of you have heard of the Mississippians? And I don't mean people from Mississippi. That means people who lived along the Mississippi River. They called the Chioka people. You ever hear them? No? All right. Let me tell you a little bit about the Chioka people. It says that around the middle 13th century, an indigenous cultural group constructed pyramids in North America along the Mississippi Delta area. Excuse me. The pyramids were 100 feet in height, but they were lost to antiquity until they were recently discovered. In 1250 AD, anthropologists estimated that Chioka people boasted a population of 20,000 residents down on Mississippi area. What they found were artifacts, trade items from the Iroquois people in Canada, right along the Mississippi River going down to Mexico. Have you? All kinds of artifacts. They were serious business, and so on. Was that in your history book? The others in yours? Well, we'll take that as a yes. All right. But it's not generally. No. Why not? Because it didn't fit the colonial framework of the United States or in Canada. All right. So I'll skip along here and talk about I'm not. Okay. I got it from Southern Illinois to Gulf of Mexico, the Mississippians or the Cherokee people established communities along the great river that bears the same name. These people engage in a number of enterprises, including agriculture, commerce, and trade, and other indigenous cultures as far east as the Iroquoian territory, west to the Siouan-speaking people, and south to the Muskegon language group in the Gulf of the Gulf Coast. Have you? Now, what's that got to do with anything? Well, what it has to do is that, I don't know about y'all, but it seems to me they were doing a little bit more than just hunting and gathering. All right? At least in that part of the continent. Here's something on governments and governance and democracy. See, that's democracy created by a lot of other people. Well, in the midst of ancient and pre-European contact into historical times, as reckoned by those seeking a new homeland and an ancient land inhabited by multi-millions of human beings, new information is being unearthed concerning the cultures, societies, languages, technologies of other original inhabitants of the Americas. The indigenous people created vibrant, creative kinship and political systems, many of which were egalitarian, not all, and their style of governance were women figured prominently. And then it goes, for following 150 years of colonial contact, the Sioux Nation Confederation, also known as the Iroquois League, stood out as the prime example of how to govern a large territory democratically. Tired of several tired of dealing with the colonies who often bickered between themselves, the Iroquois suggested the colonies form a union similar to their League of Nations. And that's precisely how we got the American government, basing it on the United States government, basing it on the Iroquoian approach to governance, in which women, well, there's a little bit there. In the Iroquoian society, women have very prominent roles. Not in the U.S. side of things. That's come along a long time after. All right. When you think about it, I know that people have read some things about Iroquoian and that sort of thing and what have you. But in terms of the profundity, in terms of the notions of equality, the notions of a right for people to speak their minds and those sorts of things and what have you, irrespective of their background, some of that didn't filter through. Well, it filtered through, but men had those roles, but they didn't necessarily transfer to the role of women in society. So, I mean, skip that's democracy. All right, what else do we have here? Oh, yes, I love this one. Any of you here of Lewis and Clark? They were explorers back in the day? Yeah, Lewis and Clark? Yeah, okay. I asked my grandmother again, she's a genius as far as I'm concerned. I said, Mama, how is it that Lewis and Clark and other explorers, you know, they're one of their claims to fame is that they charted passages and so forth and what have you. She said, yeah, that is a curious thing. She said, what do you think? And I said, well, each of them had some guides. Sacagawea was one of those guides. And she said, yeah, but, you know, we don't think they didn't have maps. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, they didn't have maps. not the way we think of maps. In other words, pieces of paper with things laid out, rivers and that sort of thing, what have you. I said, so how did she take them all over the place and which they were mapping? She said, because they had different kinds of maps. And the maps they had in those days, she told me, didn't have any credibility, generally speaking. But it was credible enough for them to follow her path. What were the maps? Rivers, certain kinds of trees, trails, mountains, hills, and all sorts of other things. But it was up here, not on paper. So really, the discoveries and so forth, and the mapping that went on that we tout, not y'all, but is touted to be such a great thing, and it is, I have no problem with it, have you? The real author of that is not the European map makers and explorers. It was Sacagawea and her knowledge of the land, for which she gets virtually no credit and hasn't received any credit for, except in association that she went with the map makers themselves, Lewis and Clark. All right? You separate that, she's nothing. You put them into the picture, she becomes somebody, which is a grotesque form of prejudice. Okay. Pharmacology. Woohoo! Yeah. Drugs. I mean, you know, medications. Well, there's all... Sorry. I had one of my uncles medicated himself, and it had nothing to do with pharmaceuticals. So think of this. Who were the medicine people, really, in a lot of the First Nations or indigenous communities? And you say, well, they were men, but most of them were women. They were the healers in the society, in those societies. And today, Weatherford says there's more than 200 drugs attributed to their work. 200 from plants and all sorts of other sources. Hunting and fishing. You know, the techniques that are used for hunting and fishing today comes from the First Nations. And Métis, as they got in on the action, actually. So here's what Weatherford said. First Nations and Inuit hunters use various calls that intimated animals and fowl. We'll do that now, but they got to add a little more. If you didn't know, that's a moose. Sort of. You know, they use those kind, and duck call.
Quack, quack.
Well, I don't think ducks do quack, quack, but whatever they do. Actually, we saw about 500 geese this morning flying over our house, going north. Actually. All right, so there's that. And then said that the use of camouflage, they were brilliant at it, using skins and animals of bison, deer, seal, polar bear. I don't know about polar bear, personally. You ever see a polar bear? I would not want to hunt one of them with a machine gun, even. They're big. In order, they use those in order to, skins, in order to, for stealth reasons, to creep up on the animals that they were hunting and that sort of thing. Still do it now. They use a variety of traps and as well bows and arrows and so on, techniques including spears, bolos, oh, that's a wicked name, various kinds of throwing spears that they would use, lots of technology, what have you. And the indigenous peoples, he says, introduced other game to Europeans that could be hunted or trapped and eaten. Possum, turkey, armadillo, alligator, bison, moose, caribou, muskox, antelope. Those are all new foodstuffs possibilities for Europeans when they came here and learned to live off and use and so forth. They use a variety of snowshoes. Yeah. Snowshoes for travel and hunting, and developed goggles. You ever see those Inuit goggles? They use the little slits in them and what have you? They are brilliant, I'm telling you. They just reduce glare like crazy. And, excuse me, toboggans, which is a Mi'kmaq word, and other items, he goes on and so forth, brought to us by the indigenous peoples of the North America in this specific instance. Then he says, Americans and Canadian indigenous agriculturalists, not often thought of as that way, particularly in the prairies, because here they were hunters and gatherers and that sort of thing, but down east and in the south, they did. So they grew crops. They grew crops that were new crops. And they were corn, tobacco, cotton, cotton oil, tomatoes, potatoes, all squashes, pumpkins, and many kinds of beans, peanuts, pecans, hickory nuts, black walnuts. I'm partial to black walnuts. I just want y'all to know that. It sort of resonates a little bit. But I'll eat a white walnut if it's done. All right, so. And syrups they use and so forth, particularly in the East, you know. Again, it's... If we're going to tell the story of Canada, then this has to be part of that story. No part can be left out. Because if any part that's left out renders the story disingenuous. Now, I'm looking around the audience here and I'm saying, well, let your grandkids learn that story. I don't want to, as Hugo Poirot says, I don't want you to destroy your little gray cells. But there's a lot to learn. And actually, for me, it's kind of fun. Okay. And I got a bibliography I can leave. I won't leave it. You can photocopy it. It's the only one I got left. I gave all my others away. Now, Canada. A few words about Canada. I'm going to give you a historical timeline, okay? And now you can make a copy of this as well, if for anyone who wants it, okay? June 24th, 1497. That was a long time ago. John Cabot landed on the Atlantic coast, possibly near the Strait of Belle Isle. Sponsored by the English King Henry VIII, Cabot was in search of a quick and easy route to the riches of the Orient, which was a legacy of Marco Polo's accounts. Okay, so he did that and so forth. He landed up in Newfoundland and then returned, because he didn't see much wealth there, Newfoundland. 1534, Jacques Cartier kidnapped two sons of Chief Donnacona, he was the chief of an Iroquois band. And this action and the erection of a Christian cross of Stratacona territory are indicative of Cartier's disrespectful attitude of First Nations people. And he was disrespectful. Cartier's was the first European to refer to the native First Nations as savages. And that term has stuck for a considerable period of time, and they were not savages. They were different. And in fact, looking back on how they were treated, you might say those who treated them so horrifically engaged in behavior that one might associate with being a savage. Okay, moving on. The in 1608, an enslavement of Africans and African descent peoples introduced to Canada until 1833. So those folks who may think that slavery didn't exist in terms of African slave trade and what have you. It did. Have you? Have any of you been to Affordville in Nova Scotia, Halifax area? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. I went there before they destroyed Affordville, what have you. And it was kind of interesting because it was a bit of a dump. You know, well, it was a bit of a dump, what have you. And one of the reasons why it was a bit of a dump is because the Halifax government wouldn't extend services. Yeah. And So that's another thing. Then we have a black United Empire loyalist arrive in Canada and experience discrimination in securing the promised land grants that they were promised. 60% received no land. Impoverished blacks often became indentured to white settlers under harsh slave-like conditions. This is in the history book. Okay? All right. So what we have here is, from my point of view, from what I can see, and I'm an American. I was born and raised there and so forth. And my wife keeps telling me on every birthday now that I'm still an American. I will say to you, kind people, I'm sorry. But there's nothing I can do about it. But because we got our own garbage down there, the lower 48, so to speak, what have you. But when my kids were going through the school system, what have you, and they would come home with stuff, and I would say, yeah, okay, that's cool, but did they tell you about this? No. Well, let's go look that up and research it so that they came out of the educational system with a rounded view of history. History is my love, what have you, and the practices that went on. And it's interesting that I was talking to our oldest, Talis, and I said, so how'd you feel about that, son, all that stuff that white people did? He said, well, Dad, he said, you know, when he looks in the mirror, he's not sure of what people see because his mom is white and I'm what I am, what have you. I said, well, I just hope they see a person. He said, yeah, but sometimes I wonder. I said, when you look in the mirror, what do you see? And he says, I see me. And I says, that's all that matters. White, brown, black, mixed, doesn't matter. Because we are created by one creator. So that's what's important. Okay. We got about 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 3? 3. 1, okay, 1. Let me get the... I'll fix you. All right. Let me get to the most evil one. No, I'm just kidding, actually. But I just want to say, there's all sorts of things with regard to how Chinese people were treated, how South Asians from India were treated. And let me end on that note, and then I got a reference to a book I'm recommending to people. Excuse me. Well, I don't know quite how to put it. Around 1912, lots of East Indians were coming. There was part of the colony, and India was part of the British Empire, as was Canada. A lot of East Indian folks were going to Vancouver. Lots of them. The premier of the province, I think his name was Bennett at the time, took umbrage with so many East Indians coming into his province, and in particular to the lower mainland, what have you, that he approached the minister responsible for fisheries and oceans and persuaded him to introduce an amendment to the Maritime Act. That amendment read like this, that any ocean vessel coming to Canada had to be able to make that journey without any stops and make it direct without any stops. The practice in India, where they would leave South India, go over to England, pick up water, food, supplies, and then make the journey, continue the journey to Vancouver. That's what he was trying to stop. Okay, so then, they implemented that, and one vessel called the Kamagata Maru left India fully loaded with East Indians and made the journey. They got to Vancouver without stopping. Okay, they were sick, hungry, putrid water, not enough food, but they made the journey. And he still denied them entry. Now, what happened? Fascinating. The people in Vancouver took umbrage with the unfairness of that rule. And they put pressure on Bennett to put pressure on the federal government to change that law. In other words, they could make escales or stops and so forth en route. And they did. The policy was what we call systemic discrimination, a system that discriminates, that appears to be unbiased, what have you. But in fact, it was discriminatory, and it was changed. And it was changed because a significant number, white people, you're not albinos, so you're not really white. In fact, I've seen blacks who are albinos, what have you. But European descent folks, of whatever kind, were the ones that spearheaded that particular change. And I want to say this, that people from those communities have also spearheaded a lot of social change. Very positive stuff. And I tell my kids and grandkids, you ought to be grateful. You need to know about this and you need to be grateful for it. And they are. And the last thing, I won't go into it, but this book here is called Clearing the Plains, The Disease, Politics of Disease, Politics of Starvation, and the Loss of Aboriginal Life. This is a scholarly work, and it's very well done, and it's not a screaming meme-y type approach to the study of the issue. That's what it is. It's not a screaming meme-y issue kind of thing. He deals with it in a scholarly way, what have you, dispassionately as well. And therefore, I think it's very useful. So, Jack Rutherford, if you see any of his works in the library, pick them up, whatever, take a look at them. And with that, I'll say I'm sorry for taking more time than I was allowed. Well, actually, I'm not sorry. I'm just going to apologize for doing it. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much once again. You've contributed to our knowledge and understanding in ways that I think maybe weren't necessarily expecting. That was a very far-reaching presentation, and I felt very strongly that what you were really talking about overall was respect. And for all of us to respect that First Nations people and other immigrants have brought a great deal to our country, and how especially the Indigenous people charted the way for government, for economic development, for mapping and exploration, for medicine and pharmaceuticals. By the way, there's a whole book on that, that it shows the Aboriginal pharmacological stuff, and then the settler stuff, and then current stuff, and you'd be surprised. Anyway, in showing us this picture of our history, a different history from what we were taught, many of us already are aware of bits and pieces, but what I think you did was you are undergirding our knowledge and our resolve to move away from the disrespect, the dismissal, the denigration that's been part of our culture, our history as we knew it from school. And it helps us to solidify our resolve to make a difference.